This is the Behave Yourself podcast, a podcast about behavioral science in the Global South, brought to you by the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. I'm your host, Linda Kimaru. In the last episode, we kicked off our series on misinformation, where we explored the insights gained from our off-the-record series, which you can check out on the Busara blog on Medium. Today, we're diving into fact-checking.
Misinformation, how this shows up in the Kenyan context, and what PESA-Check is doing about it. So Eric, before we dive in, I'd love for you to introduce
yourself.
Eric
is the managing editor at PESA-Check.
So my name is Eric Mugendi, obviously, and I'm the managing editor at PESA-Check, which is looking into misinformation right now in 9 African countries. So we started out in East Africa, but we've recently expanded to 6 new countries. Mm-hmm. And basically what we started out doing was looking into budget and public finance claims by politicians and other public figures, hence our name, which is PESA is Swahili for money. And because of the sort of work that we were doing, it sort of led naturally to looking into more general misinformation. So the reason why we started looking at budget and public finance claims initially was because of the sort of reporting that we kept seeing on mainstream media and also in on social media, talking about issues related to how resources are being utilized, allocated, and then also how people interact with budgets and just generally the ways that people use information. And
Eric, a graduate of the Bloomberg Media Initiative for Africa, has written at length about technology in Africa and has worked with organizations in 3 countries to track and combat misinformation during elections. He will be speaking to our favorite qualitative researcher, Amy Shippo, in this continuing series on misinformation. Welcome to episode 6 of Behave Yourself, Calling Your Bluff, Fact Checking in the Global South.
When you're looking at false information currently, would you say that the majority of it is pretty obvious? Or would you say now that there's this shift towards more insidious errors or false information here and there?
I'd say it's not that obvious. And the reason for that is because a lot of the misinformation that we've seen tends to be very focused on issues where there isn't that much information that can easily debunk it. So the main thing that we found that has contributed to, I'd say, the rise of false information is the fact that a lot of these issues and a lot of these things that people are looking at tend to be fairly new stories or stories that don't have stories that are very, very technical. Mm. Or that have a lot of layers to them that need a lot of unpacking. So because a lot of times the information tends to be fairly like expert level when it comes to interpreting and understanding it, that's where like people start to take shortcuts or people sort of try to interpret these things for themselves. And then if the foundation on which this knowledge is based is flawed, then the conclusions are going to be like flawed as well. Mm. So the other thing that we've seen is the main contributor to the spread of false information is the changes in how people consume information. Because initially we used to have the media take like a more authoritative position in terms of sharing information and being the expert in the room, so they'd break things down for people and allow them to understand these things and unpack them in essentially like a safe space. Mm. But now it's changed like really quickly, where we're seeing literally anyone with a Twitter account can break a news story. And the steps and the processes that people would previously go through in terms of verifying information and making sure that it's moving from one stage to another and all the verification steps have been taken isn't really happening as much. Because even like we've seen mainstream media outlets sort of compete with bloggers and social media users to break stories. Yeah. And now there's that need to sensationalize, because there's a really big premium on clicks and because of the changing revenue models as well. So like it makes money to publish a fake story and get people to click on it than to put money into like a hardcore investigative story.
Interesting. So it sounds like it went from more formalized media houses to now more individual content creators, when where everyone can be putting out something. And so I'm curious, take me through your process, because there is so much content on the internet right now. How do you identify what is fake, what's out there? How do you even sift through all of this information online?
So the first thing that we try to do is to isolate the actual claim that's being made. Because a lot of times we find that people will throw in lots of information, and then some of it might be true, and then the true information is used to cloak information that's false. So we try to dig through the stories and the news and the information that people are consuming and finding those things that we can actually check. Because the thing that we try to differentiate is claims and opinions. So opinions are like, this is what I think, this is what I feel, and it's really hard to check those. Actually, we try not to check those, because you don't know where the line is drawn. But then as the moment that someone says something that is based on data, or that's based on something that we can actually check, that's when we try to look into it. And then once we identify the claim, we figure out the source of the claim. So is it something that's been published in a newspaper? Is it online? Is it a video? Is it, like, where was it published? Because the context in which it's been published really informs, like, whether the information is actually credible. So sometimes you find that someone attributes a false claim to some random source, and then they say that this person or this individual said this, even though they didn't actually say it. And then once we identify the source and we see that it's something credible and it's a platform that has been used before to publish credible information, then we look for data to either support or debunk the claim. So this is really crucial, because a lot of times the source is integral to the fact check, because it becomes a basis on which you build your evidence. And the sources that we try to use are official data or credible organizations. So for example, with this whole COVID situation, we found that the World Health Organization has been a really fantastic source of information in terms of research on vaccines and trying to share information on cures that or claims about cures that don't really work. And then in addition to that, we found that people are trying to attack the character of entities like the WHO, because they know that if they get people to question the credible authorities or credible entities, then that sort of poisons all the information that's come out of them. So it's really important to base our fact checks on credible sources and credible individuals. And then once we've identified the data or the source that we use to build the fact check, then we try to find supporting evidence. So we try not to rely on single sources, because one source can say something that agrees with your fact check, but then if you do some research and you find five other sources that disagree with it, that means your conclusion is false. And then once you find multiple supporting sources of evidence, we move on to building the fact check and coming to a conclusion, which then becomes the fact check itself. Like, we essentially have a fact check that identifies a claim, identifies the person who made the claim, where it was published, and has the data either supporting or debunking it. And then, yeah, it also has, it presents the evidence in a clear and conclusive manner.
So if I'm a consumer and then I go to that, the primary source of where I'm reading the information, would I know that it's false, or that there's credible sources saying something opposite? How would I know the validity of that information? Would I have to go to your site separately?
So right now we actually do have a partnership with Facebook, where we put our fact checks alongside potentially false content. So what happens when you're on Facebook and you see something that's false that we have fact-checked, it has a label on it saying this has been looked at by a third-party fact-checking organization.
Nice.
And because of that, you can make the decision for yourself whether you want to see the information or not. And we've seen other platforms try to put in similar labels where they add context to information that's on there. So the main thing that the platforms are trying to avoid is a situation where they're actually policing content. So they've given us the work of looking into this information, because we are actually accredited by the International Fact-Checking Network. It makes it clear that we are actually doing this work as a credible and a legitimate organization doing the fact-checking work that we do. So unfortunately, we can't really look into every false claim because there's a lot of content and there's lots of stuff people talk about and producing all the time.
Right.
But for the most part, we try to identify things that are going viral or things that lots of people are talking about when trying to decide what to fact check.
Mm. As behavioral scientists, we are really interested in nudges that help people make informed decisions. And it sounds like your caveat on this has been checked by a fact checker is one of those types of nudges. And I'm curious how you came up with the messaging. Describe to me what that looks like. What would I see on Facebook?
So you would see, if it's an image, it would be grayed out. And then on top of it, it has a warning label saying this is potentially false, find mm-hmm. out more. And then underneath the particular piece of content, it has the headline or the fact check that we've done. So what this has actually made us do is to sort of compress as much information about the fact check as we can in the headline, because that's the immediately visible bit of the fact check that people can see. Mm. And then if they want to read more, they can tap on the link to our fact check, and then they're taken to our site, and then they will read more about the information they're consuming. And so there's lots of different labels, and I think right now there's 9 different ratings that can be attached to content on Facebook. So if it's true, then that's not really visible. But for things like an article with a false headline, or an article with an article that's been found to be false, or something where the information within is satire or it's a parody, then we've actually designed icons that go alongside the image. So what happens is you see the headline of the article, and then there's the featured image on the article itself, which is like a sort of banner, which has the, like a stop sign, well, for content that's false. And then if it's satire, it has the smiling and frowning mask. And then, so it's like, we're trying to be clever with the ratings and then the different colors as well. So it's almost like it goes from red for false to green for true. So it's almost like priming people to know that if they see this color, that's a warning, or if they see this less visible or less flashy warning color, then that's, it's something that they should probably pay attention to, but it's not as bad. So it's almost like a scale of badness. Yeah.
Right. It sounds like you've been very intentional with your visual cues, which is great.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you said that you are working across 9 different countries. So I'm wondering if you've had to contextualize any of this priming as you're entering a new country.
So the first thing that we do is language, because actually 4 of those countries are Francophone. Mm. So we've had to translate the text, and sometimes we've had to adapt it, because like you find the direct translation of, let's say, partially false or literally false headline doesn't really work as well in French. So we find that adapting a similar word or a word that has a similar implication in this other language works better. So we've had to adapt our headlines, and then also we've had to, but the imagery has been consistent in terms of this is the stop sign for false, the green check mark for true, and then a couple of other visual cues. So the visual cues are the same, but then we've had to adapt the language.
Among these countries, are there any differences in terms of laws about free speech or the consequences of spreading misinformation or disinformation that you've had to be cognizant of?
So Ethiopia, which is a country we started working in, I think in May, they've actually tried to introduce a law against misinformation and trying to punish people for spreading false information. Mm. And one of the main things that we've had to do is to like not really put people in danger per se for sharing false information, because that's a potentially unintended consequence of the work that we do. So if we have a bunch of different warnings telling people that this person is spreading false information, then that could be a signal that the government uses to say, well, you're spreading false information and you're breaking the law, so this is what we're going to do to you, or something like that.
Mm.
And the other thing that we've seen is in Tanzania, where the government basically said we can't really do like hardcore fact-checking. So the sort of budget public finance fact-checking we were doing in the country, we had to stop that because they said that any data that is produced by the government is official and you can't really do any additional research of your own. So as a result, we had to like pull back on the hardcore fact-checking, and we had to focus on much more a much softer social issues, like things like education and health. So we had to change our approach in these countries, and we've also had to, because we're constantly trying to adapt the work that we're doing to make it make sense for the people in these countries and make sure that the way that we are communicating the warnings isn't mistaken. And we're also trying to figure out what sort of false information people are falling for.
It's time for a quick break and your behavioral science term of the week. In this episode, you will hear Eric talk a lot about the way we consume media, especially online. This is a perfect example of when the concept of friction can be a good thing in design. Friction is anything that prevents users from getting something done, like the pop-up that asks you if you're really sure you want to delete that file. The seamless nature of the way we use, consume, and share content, especially online, is showing us that there aren't many opportunities in the user experience for people to slow down and pay attention to the media they consume. And maybe this is one aspect of what fact-checking organizations can consider as they design their interventions. Now, back to the episode.
As fact-checkers, it almost sounds like you're functioning like civil society and holding these governments accountable, which can be a bit inflammatory. I'm curious, you said that you're trying to understand the people in the countries that you work in and what they're interested in learning about and how they're processing information. I wonder how you're getting feedback from them about that process, about how they're learning about media.
So one of the main things that we've tried to do is to run ads in these countries where, like, we tell people that we exist as a fact-checking organization, we're working in this country. So if you have anything that you want to be fact-checked, you can send it to us. So we actually have a WhatsApp tip line where people send us things that they want us to fact-check. So the main thing that we've tried to do is to ask people what matters to you as a consumer of information online, and what would you like us to look into? And a lot of times the things that we've seen is people tell us that we've seen a lot of health-related misinformation. So that's the main thing that we try to build on, because this also gives us a way to reach people who aren't necessarily plugged into our networks or who might just be casually consuming information, and then they come across a false health-related claim that we've debunked, and then they know we exist and this is how they can reach us. So it becomes really integral for us to try to sort of make our content make sense in the different contexts that we're operating in. And that involves a lot of like analytics as well. So trying to figure out how old the people are. For example, we found that when we're doing the budget and public finance related claims, we tended to get a lot of like people aged like 25 to 35 in Kenya. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were male and a lot of them were like politically inclined, because the information that we were producing on how the government is working was really useful for them within the conversations that they were having in their groups to sort of agitate the government to deliver services better. Mm-hmm. So building on this core audience, now we tried to figure out how do we diversify? How do you get like just anyone who's interested in misinformation, disinformation in general? Because we were essentially changing gears. We still do produce budget and public finance related content, but now we are looking at things like, does drinking garlic water protect you from COVID-19? Or some random things like job scans as well, which we found that because we've been covering a lot of this type of content where people actually create fake Facebook pages for companies and then ask people to send them money as an application fee, we found that more young people are becoming interested in the stuff that we're doing. So we've been able to see how people respond to the content that we've been pushing out through Facebook analytics, and then also through analytics on our website. And we found that there's been a lot of interest, especially from Francophone countries, because the countries we're currently in Francophone West Africa are Niger and Mali, where the media landscape is somewhat fragmented. There isn't like that coordinated media space as we have in Kenya, because In Kenya, we have things like a guild, like an editor's guild, a journalists union, and a bunch of other things. So we have all of these different institutions that don't really exist in these other countries. So essentially, at some level, we are the news in these countries, and we're credible, and because we put a lot of work in our research. So we've seen a lot of interest in syndication as well. So media entities in these countries have approached us and asked us, can we republish your content? Because we want to get like some sort of insight in the work, in the media landscape or the stories that people are consuming. So as a result, I think we have, we're trying lots of different things. Yeah. So we're trying to employ analytics, so trying to sort of fragment our audiences in a way that we can deliver niche content. And then also we're trying to keep in mind that the content we're producing in one country can make sense to other people in lots of other countries. So how can we then try to cover as much of that as we can?
I love that you're trying to diversify your content and continually thinking about what makes sense for consumers across different countries. And what is exciting is how you're using analytics to inform your decision making. And that's something that we think a lot about at Busara. If we can't measure it, we can't move it. So it's great that you're of the same mindset. I'm curious about fake news. And I mean, obviously we know that fake news is everywhere all the time now, but there are certain instances where we know that there's going to be more than usual. There will be flares. Especially around election periods. So what can fact-checking organizations do, or even content creators, to anticipate the spread of misinformation?
So I'd say the main thing that fact-checkers and fact-checking organizations can do is sort of work on media literacy. So that's building the awareness of certain tools and certain platforms that people can use to check and verify information for themselves. Because like I mentioned earlier, fact checkers can't check everything. Try as we might, we can't look into all of the false information that's circulating. But if the people who consume this false information know what to look out for, so for example, if someone sends them an image and says this is happening in this place, or someone sends them a message, like the way a lot of these health things about COVID-19 have been circulating, then if we try to get people to question all the information they're consuming and not just forward it, because a lot of the defenses that people use tend to focus around, oh, but I didn't know it was false when I was sending it, or I was sending it because I believe that I was doing everyone a favor by sharing it on this platform. So by getting people to question the information they're consuming in a way that makes them sort of slow down their consumption of information and try to prevent the spread or the further spread of this false information by stopping themselves from spreading it, then we can sort of build a culture where people are verifying information for themselves. And I'd say one of the main things that is lacking in a lot of these conversations is the role of mainstream media. Because it's like almost like what they do is we publish stories on the newspaper and or we show them on TV and then we walk away because our work here is done. But if instead of trying to compete with social media users or people who publish content on social media to break stories, and then if they focused more on giving context or explaining the nuances of these stories so that you know that you can watch the news not to get the story because you've already found out like literally minutes after a story breaks that this is what's happening, but you can actually get the context and the nuance and it gets explained to you in a way that makes sense to you in your context, then mainstream media can actually add value to this conversation. But I feel like they've been quite lacking in this whole situation. And because one of the main things that I'd say, in addition to media literacy, is awareness of these tools and awareness of the ways that people can actually verify this information for themselves within their contexts. And this actually is going to contribute quite a lot to the overall usability of these tools, because a lot of times they lack local examples. Yeah. So if you try to do a reverse image search of, let's say, the street right here right outside my house, you're not really going to find like an actual image of that versus, I'd say, some random highway in the middle of Arizona. And you find that a lot of this is because of the lack of locally relevant examples, and there's some biases in the algorithms. And you consider that the tech companies building these tools are based, a lot of them in California, some of them have offices in Ireland, and they treat Europe, Middle East, and Africa as one big, enormous, homogenous block. But if you look at the examples and the sort of content and the quality of the content we're looking at, it can be quite restricted. So it becomes a big challenge to sort of unpack or to get people to use these tools for themselves or in their own personal contexts.
So instead of retrofitting Western ideas and mechanisms to the Global South context, where do you see the Global South taking this forward in the next 5 years?
I'd say probably like contributing a lot more in terms of localizing, you know, or providing local examples for these tech companies to use when they're building their algorithms. Mm-hmm. And then also, like, because one of the main things that we've noticed is even the way certain stories or certain claims are shared, sometimes they have like local slang or like words that mean something in one context. But then if you look at it in the context of the person who's sharing them, they don't really have the same meaning. Mm. So one way that I'd say some of the platforms are trying to like localize or trying to understand the way people are consuming and sharing information is by using local people in these countries as sort of like a step in terms of verifying this information. So they have like content moderators based in these countries. So you try to ask them, how many people do you have? Because you can imagine that, let's say Kenya, a country of 47 million people, if you have just a room full of like 15 people moderating content for a whole country, even if you consider how many people are online, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are going to pass like some of these filters. And then because it's a really like labor intensive process, so you have one person literally looking at everything that's been reported, and it's hard. It's actually like one of the most stressful jobs because you're looking at lots of things, and things that have been tagged as literally everything. So in the end, what I'd say the biggest contribution that we can give as the Global South is probably trying to find like, or trying to inform the policies that these platforms use, so that we don't have a situation where like you find Facebook coming in and saying, we're going to zero rate the internet because we believe this is the biggest problem. And people then start using these platforms to spread false information in a language that Facebook doesn't understand. Mm. And that's going to lead to certain problems further down the road.
Absolutely.
And just trying to adapt a lot of these things to local contexts and even finding ways to make sure that the main languages, the main non-English or non, I'd say, UN languages that are used in these countries are represented in terms of moderation and in terms of trying to make sure that people don't really spread information that could lead to offline harm.
I have so many follow-up questions, but I want to be conscious of your time. So I'm just going to ask you one more question that I've been mulling over a bit, which is, in our current climate, and as political polarization increases globally, sometimes news may be false, but it's backed by an expert or by powerful people. So how do third-party fact-checkers address this important but often politicized news?
So the main thing that we try to do is to find the best available evidence to either support or debunk a claim. Mm-hmm. So we try to be as neutral, as agnostic as possible in terms of looking at this information. Because once you strip out the intent of the person or the entity that's sharing this information, it makes it easier to compare the claim that's being made with the available evidence and the available data. But then that doesn't mean we don't consider the intent, because it's really important to factor in what the person who's sharing this information is looking to achieve. So in situations where we find like the politics of the person is sort of clouding the judgment, or they're trying to use the political climate to advance a certain agenda or a certain issue, then we try to communicate that and we try to tell people that. this person sharing this information is of a certain leaning, which mm-hmm. could be why they shared this information. So it's really hard to get into someone's head and say they shared this because of this reason. But then once we try to compare what's been said with the best available evidence, and then this is evidence that stands up to scrutiny as well. So we're not just looking at something that that's temporary or something that's really not critically evaluated or in a way that that has been, that makes sense for as many people as possible. So that it's not, we're not trying to build consensus, because this is one of those things where it's absolute. It's either true or it's not. But then in the fact-checking work that we do, we're trying to establish the type of falsehood. So we're trying to tell people, is it the headline that's false? Is it the piece of content? Is it a video or photo that's been taken out of context? Is it a wrong interpretation of something that's credible? Or is it something that that's much more nuanced? So is it, for example, something where it was like a bad translation? Like, we actually had to look at a claim where an Egyptian paper reported that an Ethiopian minister had said that the Nile is now a lake because of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. And we actually looked at it and we saw that. The reason why they reported this was because they put the tweet on Google Translate. And Google Translate was wrong, translating the Amharic to Arabic. So this was communicated, and then there was a lot of outrage in Egypt because people are basing their reactions to a flawed statement or flawed translation. So by divorcing the context from the content and then looking at it in that particular scenario, and then now adding back the context as a way to sort of make sense of everything, like in a more wholesome or a more fully developed way, we're able to sort of make sense of this information for people. So we're not trying to interpret things for people or trying to understand things for people. We're trying to give context for them to understand for themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to hold on to that phrase. You're working to not divorce content from context. I think that's a great way to leave. Thank you so much, Eric. We really, really appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure having you on today.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of episode 6. Many thanks to our guest, Eric Mukendi from PESACHECK. You can see more of the work that he does at www.pesacheck.org. That is PESACHECK.org. And there's also a link to that in the show notes. Behave Yourself is a production of the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. Find us on Twitter at Busara Center and read more about the Off the Record series mentioned in this episode on the Busara blog on Medium. Until next time, remember, behave yourself.